This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
I'm sick with this, I'm sick with this. Since you wasn't the button, lost judgment. My own sweet time didn't teach what I found. I didn't recognize simple things anymore. I don't want to be defeated, I don't want to be defeated. I don't want to be defeated, I don't want to be defeated.
Hi. Everybody, how's it going? Welcome to another episode of the podcast, Lead Singer Syndrome, episode, what are we at? 165. Can you believe it? Wow. It's February 12th, 2019 at the moment. Maybe you're listening to this far away off in the distant future. I don't know, but I'm sitting here looking out my window in an incredible snowstorm, ice storm. I don't even know what it is. Tomorrow is my 38th birthday. And I don't know. You know, life is good. Life is good. But I got to say, when you have your birthday in the middle of February like I do, and you're from Canada, I remember very few nice days on my birthday. Typically, yep, they're ice storms, snowstorms, some kind of miserable weather where you're stuck inside, but I hope the tree outside doesn't fall down on my house. The weight of the ice is, it's looking a little, I don't love it. But hey, regardless, that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about music, lead singers. That's what the show's all about. I speak with other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a band. And today we have a great guest, a very requested guest. A lot of people have asked for this man for a long time, and it's very easy to see why. If you talk about a guy in our scene that's done a lot of stuff and a lot of great stuff, it is this man, Kurt Travis, formerly of A Lot Like Birds, formerly of Dance Gavin Dance, currently of, Royal Coda, Pushover, Eternity Forever, also doing tons of solo stuff. This guy wears a lot of hats. He's got a hat collection. And I was so happy to speak with him. And then once we finished this thing, I think my mouth was open for like an hour after this interview was over, because so much stuff here, eye-opening stuff, interesting stuff, and I can't wait for you all to hear it. Before we jump on into that, a little reminder, you can get in touch. Very simple, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. I got to say, I've been getting so many emails lately, and I love that. I love to hear from all the people, and I don't know, maybe it's because, like I was talking about the weather outside, it's so crappy. You're just inside listening to podcasts. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but yeah, hit me up on there if you want to. If you're not so happy, if we forgot to talk enough about, you know, I don't know, what was 5 minute ride or the joy, whatever it is, you can also call the hate line, 657-666-HATE. Leave me some hate. You can vent, you know, you can vent about just what about whatever, the cold temperatures, impending government shutdowns. It's really all good. It doesn't have to necessarily be direct hate to me, but I do like the hate. I do like the hate. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter. We're on all those things as well. And I don't know, if you like the show, feel free to go on iTunes, write a review. And when you've done all that and you've got nothing left to do, we got like 164 other episodes you can, you know, go back and check out. And if you've done that, all that stuff, and you're a super fan of the show, make sure you check out the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. I thought it was really kind of a funny story. I was in Omaha and Des Moines, Iowa, doing a couple emo night shows, which are, they're a good time. I enjoy doing them. Shout out to everybody I saw out there in the Midwest, and shout out to all the people running it. It was a really, really great party. Sold out in Omaha. It was really cool. And somebody walked up to me with a, you know, the screenshot of one of the episodes that I did. I think it was with Fiddlar, or just maybe he was just talking about the podcast. And he had his phone in one hand and $20 in the other hand. And he was like, here, it's free content here. And I'm like, No, dude, I'm not taking your money. But you know what I will? I will take your money if you sign up for the All Access Club. And then, you know, you'll get some stuff. So he's in. Welcome, Doug Keady. There's so many new members. It has been very cool lately how many people have signed up. So all I ask is you check it out again. The link, leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. I want to thank everybody who sent me birthday presents already. I got a record player yesterday. How fucking cool is that? I also got a Nintendo Switch game, bunch of clothing, a bunch of gift cards. You guys are too sweet. So thank you very, very much. It makes me feel a little less sad about being 2 years from age 40. Yikes. All right. Well, hey, let's get in to this week's episode and my talk with Kurt Travis. Feel her touch. It's almost impossible to hold still. Maybe we can go back to the way it was. Well, at least let me love you the same. I got lies to tell your children. I'm here with Kurt Travis. Dude, it's been a long time. How are you, man? What's up?
I'm good, man. How are you, Shane? I'm just here in Long Island, New York, and, you know, finishing up my solo album. I've been here since January 27th, so
cool.
We're tracking vocals now, so.
Cool. Very cool.
That's where we
it's,
at.
You yep. know, it's funny, with most people, you know, in music, you go to their Twitter and you say, and it says, "Oh, I'm tracking vocals tomorrow," which, you know, you dropped on your Twitter, I think, yesterday.
Yeah.
And most people, it's like, "Oh, okay." Like, I figure they're in this project, they're doing this band. With you, it's like it could be literally anything. Yeah. Because you have so many things on the go. But this is another solo album.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's exciting because I haven't put one out in, I want to say, like 4 years. So the last one was a full-length effort, and had my buddy Joseph Arrington play drums on the last one. So I decided, yo, Joe, come out and put your magic on this new album. And it's been great so far. So
yeah, that's very, very cool. And like, you know, you've collaborated with so many different people, written songs with so many people. When it's time for you to do another solo album, what goes through your head? Is it about trying to get out the things you couldn't get out with the other projects, you know, in the last 4 years? You know, where do you kind of dig for, you know, either things to talk about, musical ideas? How does that kind of go when you're doing a solo album?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, when I'm playing with kind of a rock outfit, it's definitely more aggressive. It's more top of my range, kind of yelly, screamy at times. But my solo stuff is definitely just basically exactly what I like to do. It comes out kind of like an indie pop sort of thing, because that's what I kind of gravitate to when, you know, when I'm just, you know, sitting around and you know, trying to inspire it is, you know, I love, you know, Mac DeMarco and like Tame Impala and stuff like that. And
have you ever seen Mac DeMarco live?
I have once.
He's crazy. Like so out of his mind. We were in Germany just like a couple months ago, and we had like a day off, and we'd played the same venue and he was playing, so we were able to just kind of sneak in the back door and watch his set.
That's so cool.
And it was crazy, like how the music is so mellow, but he's up there like he's fucking Henry Rollins or something.
Oh yeah, no, the guy's a crazy character.
Yeah, and he's, you know, he's Canadian, so he's my homie, I guess, by nationality at least. So yeah, that's crazy that you bring up those kind of acts, because, you know, I think it's funny how so many of us that are known for very, very aggressive singing or screaming, tend to gravitate towards like really mellow shit. You know, like Like David Bazan, Pedro the Lion is like one of my favorite artists, oh my God. You know, and yes. That's like something that maybe you don't would never hear in my music. So it's kind of interesting that you have the same, you know, sort of story there with Tame Impala and Mac DeMarco.
Yeah, I think that the, you know, the softer side definitely fuels the other side, because when I do a record, you know, one of my solo records, I tend to gravitate more towards the aggressive and vice versa. You know, they kind of fuel each other. And even on like the first Dance Gavin Dance record, I was listening to a lot of Bjork and just a lot of like Sigur Rós and Mum and just like really post rock. I feel like it rejuvenates you. It makes you kind of okay with the situation you're in, and inspires you in a you know indirect way. So,
absolutely. So do you collaborate with people when you write solo music, or is it just you? I mean, you said obviously the drummer. You said you brought in Paul, but do you write 100%? Are you playing all the guitars on this stuff? How does that kind of work? You know, just logistically.
Yeah. So this record I did, which was called "Everything Is Beautiful."
Yeah.
Me and Zachary Dan from the Strawberry Girls, he actually helped me write about half of the record. And he would, we live pretty close to each other in California. We live like about 3 hours away. So he would drive up to Sacramento and hang out with me for a weekend, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days at a time. And sometimes we would, you know, we'd get done a lot of stuff and then, you know, sometimes not so much. But yeah, he collaborated with me on that record. And this record, one of my friends from high school, his name's Matthew Tucker, really, really amazing drummer. And he's really good with Ableton. He does a lot of things with synths and stuff like that. And so there's a song that me and him have collaborated on this one. So yeah, even though it's, you know, under Kurt Travis, there's a lot of people helping me and, you know, kind of guiding me. Same thing. Mike Watts is, you know, just really good at tone, like just really good tones and like getting different snare sounds and different guitar sounds. So I would say like, I wrote the bulk of it, but I'm definitely having help. That's for sure.
Definitely, dude. Is it going to come out? Are you signed to a label? Who's paying for this to be released? And when can we expect it?
Yeah. So this one, I'm actually doing it on my own. I have a record label called Esk Records.
Yes. Yes, you do.
And yeah. So I've never really put out my own solo album on my own label. So this will be a first for me. And yeah, it's totally an all-in thing. I'm paying for it all. You know, I flew Joe in. And yeah, just I'm really excited because you obviously know, like, you know, when you have an effort that's not on the label, there's no hands in the cookie jar. You're literally just getting everything. So
well, yeah, totally. And I mean with the way streaming is these days, you know, there actually is money, you know, that comes through then that way.
Totally.
So I totally get that, but of course there's a fear, is anyone going to listen to this stuff? Is anyone going to know about this stuff?
Right.
Which is why bands tend to give up literally 80%, you know, to labels, because there's a fear there.
I guess
you've just done so many projects over the years that you have such a reputation because you've put out a lot of very good music that you're not too afraid of that.
Not anymore. Yeah, absolutely. Like I've been around a lot of labels. I've been around a lot of recording studios and I've just, you know, tried to learn as much as I possibly could. And yeah, I think at this point, a lot of people know who I am and like my fan base is pretty vast. So I feel like if I can't get it out myself, then, you know, oh well.
Right. On to the next Kurt Travis project. Right. And I'm sure there will be many. Wonderful, dude. Well, really good to speak with you, man. Thanks for taking the time out of the studio to do this. So I want to go back and I want to talk about the early days, your early life.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you're aware of this. You're a bit of an enigma. It's a bit hard to find, you know, a lot of information about you. You know, I do this podcast regularly.
Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of people and a lot of times I can kind of find out this stuff, but I actually had quite a bit of trouble. And I don't know if that is because you're a private person. If it's just the kind of thing that's buried so deep in the internet, it's not findable, but, but I'd really love to talk to you just about what it was like, you know, with your upbringing in California. You know, what was it like with your family structure? Did you have brothers and sisters? How was it in school? And then, of course, how did you start getting into music?
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, I mean, I was born in Scottsdale, Arizona, actually. Okay. And because my father has family there. And they were visiting, and then my mom went into labor, and so that's what happened. But
okay,
yeah. But I grew up in Sacramento, California, and pretty much raised there in a town called Citrus Heights, California, just like a suburb of Sac. And I was an only child for about 10 years. Yeah, when I was 10, my parents got divorced when I was 2. And then it was just me and my mom until I was 10. And then at 10 years old, my mom remarried and had 4 more siblings, 3 brothers and a sister. Yeah.
Wow, what a separation.
Yeah. So, the first sibling was my brother Jordan. And we're 10 years apart. And then every sibling after that is 2 years.
Okay.
So my brother Jordan, my sister Rachel, my brother Aaron, and my littlest brother Alex. And
wow.
And so I went from only child to big family, built-in babysitter sort of thing.
Right.
No, it was cool though. It was really cool. I always wanted to have brothers and sisters, you know, and just, you know, I didn't like the whole I'm the only one here. You know?
Right. Well, yeah, so, sure. I mean, I guess I had a sister that was quite a bit older than me too, and I can understand, you know, that, you know, how that works.
Totally. Yeah. And also, you know, I just really like, I wanted a father too. Like my biological father wasn't there. I mean, I pretty much saw him maybe once every 3 years or something like that. He's very busy. This is another thing that people don't know about me is my biological father, his name is Kurt Thomas. And he was a 3-time gold medalist in the 1976 World Championships for gymnastics.
Wow.
Yeah, and he actually invented a move called the Thomas Flair, which a lot of people do in breakdancing. It's kind of like a scissory looking It's not a minwheel or I think that's what they call it, but it's when you have your hands on the ground and you're doing a circle and then you like spread your legs out to kind of do like this scissor thing.
Oh wow!
And
okay.
He was the first one to do it. You know, yeah, my mother was a gymnast and a professional dancer for Adidas and Reebok, and you know, things like that. So my childhood was pretty crazy. We were always driving back and forth from LA because that's where the dance companies were or the gymnastics meets that that my mother would attend. And there's that. Then
Wow, isn't that interesting? I remember Kurt Thomas. I think Kurt Thomas was a player for the New York Knicks.
Right.
I was like, that can't be the guy.
No, yeah.
But no, I'm on the Wikipedia page. That's very interesting. Yeah.
It's crazy.
A bunch of gold medals and even a Razzie. for apparently for one of the worst movie performances.
Oh,
in 1985. Apparently, yeah, I'm just reading it right now.
Yeah,
Jim Cotta. You know this? Okay,
yes.
Yeah. Wow, this is
you know
wow,
what's
there
crazy.
We go.
Yeah, so because of that movie, Jim Cotta, there was I was watching Family Guy one day, and they're doing this snippet of my dad's movie, Jim Cotta, and I was like, oh my
wow.
God, I was rolling because like I of course I recognized the scene and everything, and it was just I don't know, it was just crazy. I was just like, oh my God, that. But when I was a kid, I would watch that movie all the time because, I mean, I didn't really get to see my father that much. But
right.
But yeah, I was just like, oh, that's my dad on a sort of a B movie sort of situation. But yeah.
Do you have a relationship with him now?
Kind of. You know what? I have a half brother named Hunter, and he
right.
actually, me and him reconnected because of my music career. It's crazy. And he started hitting me up, and we have a really good relationship. Actually, he comes to my shows, and they actually live in Texas. So whenever
okay.
I'm in Texas, I put him on the guest list and we hang out and stuff. And so yeah, like I don't really have a very close relationship with Kurt. His name is Kurt as well.
Yep.
But his son actually and him have kind of reconnected. So it's pretty cool. He my dad is a lot like me. Like we're very focused and just zealous about our craft. And he owns a gymnastics gym in Texas, and he's just. He's obsessive about it. I know
right.
he is. And he's always doing something just like me. Like I am just never in one place at one time. So yeah, I mean, we've talked and we've hung out from time to time, but really I hang out with Hunter more, and he's a DJ and you know, he's doing that thing. So there's that kind of common thread there of, you know, just music. And he likes to pick my brain about the industry and,
right.
and whatnot. And I'm like, hey, man, it's like I feel like the DJ world and our world is kind of two different things. But
totally.
But I try to help him as much as I can. So,
crazy. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really very interesting. So you had, but I mean, you had a bio, you had a stepfather growing up, I guess.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like your, how do I say it? Like I was going to put it in management terms. Like he was your day to day.
Yes.
Right.
He was. Absolutely.
Is your mom and your stepdad still together? What's the
yeah.
relationship with your family there? They're like now.
Yep. They've been happily married since I was 10, so I'm 35 now. My math is horrible. I
can't figure that out either.
Exactly. But yeah, they're still going strong. You know, I actually changed my name from Kurt Thomas to Kurt Travis when my parents remarried, and so he adopted me,
yep,
so to speak. And I mean it's been cool. He was a youth pastor when my parents got together, and
wow,
he's always been very active in the church, and so is my mom. Actually, they're very active in their own community and whatnot, and as a 10-year-old, as like, you know, 12 years old, having a youth pastor for a stepfather, I mean, it was not your typical Cinderella situation. It was like, I was so loved and so cared for. It was awesome. And I needed that structure. And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, obviously in my adolescence, it was like, you know, screw you. But, you know, it still, they showered me with love, and we weren't the wealthiest family. We were actually pretty poor, but it didn't matter, you know. He went to every single one of my soccer games. He's gone to countless shows that I've played. He's even when I would skateboard, he would take me to the skate park. And so, yeah, I mean, it was the father that I didn't have. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So how did music, become involved? I mean, you mentioned the church, you're a singer. A lot
Absolutely.
Of times that's kind of how it starts.
I totally did, man. I was bored to tears in church, but threw a guitar in my hand and I literally couldn't put it down. And so this was before the internet. So I would collect these worship songs with chords on the top of the sheets. It was like, okay, here's a song. And I'd collect them like Pokemon cards, man. I'd be like, oh, I don't have that one, And I'd go up to the worship leaders. Yeah, I'd go up to the worship leaders and I'd be like, can I have that one? Can I have it? It has a chord on there. I don't know yet. And so, I really kind of took flight there. And the worship team would let me play. It was a small church, so it wasn't like a humongous operation, but they'd let me play rhythm guitar, and I actually even played drums at one point, and bass, and it was really fun. It definitely engaged me in what was going on, and just kind of solidified my love for music, really. And it was really cool, and there's a lot of people in my family that are drummers, are singers. My grandfather was a Frank Sinatra, like lounge singer style.
Right. I was going to say, if your grandfather's Frank Sinatra, then we got a lot more to talk about.
just he loved to sing Frank. He loved to sing that style, kind of that big band sound. And had a very boomy voice, and I kind of
took it the other way there.
Exactly. So, yeah. So, I mean, when we would go camping, we'd all sing songs around the fire and that sort of thing. And I remember when I first got a guitar, I was like 6 years old, and I broke it. Basically, I didn't even play it, and it was too young. But then when I was 13, my Uncle Wes actually gave me a guitar. And it was still a crappy guitar, but they were like, all right, if you really want to play, then you'll play this crappy guitar, and then you'll outgrow it, and we'll give you another one. Because he had a bunch of guitars. And so that's exactly what happened. I played that thing until I was like, Uncle Wes, this thing doesn't hold a tune, and the strings are,
Do you remember what kind of guitar it was, and do you still have it?
It's really interesting. It was called a Trump guitar.
Oh, no.
Isn't that nuts? And it's kind of funny. It's kind of a joke nowadays. My Uncle Wes will be like, hey, do you remember the name of your first guitar? And I was like, don't say it. Don't say it. Don't say it. I don't want anybody to know. But yeah, it was actually a Trump guitar. I don't know if he made guitars or what.
I highly doubt it.
But yeah, it said Trump on the headstock, and and that thing was a piece of crap. It was like it was just the worst, dude. You'd tune the low E, and you'd get all the way down to the high E, and the low E would be out. You know what I mean? And the action was so bad. But it was a good beginner guitar. It was literally like, just something for me to bang on before I got something substantial. And yeah, so the next guitar he gave me was the camping guitar. It was the old Fender acoustic, and it was all banged up. But it sounded great, and it kept a tune, and I was so thankful. I was so happy to have finally a guitar that would stay in tune.
Cool. So you're playing acoustic guitar by yourself. I'm trying to connect the dots, how you go from that and the church life to, getting into the music scene in Sacramento, because, in the late 90s when you're growing up, and then into the early 2000s, there was a lot going on. So how did
Absolutely.
That start? I mean, I guess it was probably some school friends, because you were in some early bands, you know, like Five Minute Ride,
yes.
Overjoy.
Yeah.
Records that still hold up pretty well, to be honest with you. But before
thank
we
you,
get
man.
Into that, how did that transition come? Like, how did you start playing in bands and stuff?
So, yeah. So, I was a senior in high school, and my class was just kind of, I mean, there was bands in my class, but they were very Green Day. They were very kind of punk rock. And for me, I loved punk rock, but I wanted something a little bit more. And, actually it was the class of 2004, the sophomores at the time, that were really making, you know, in my opinion, more innovative music. And so I would hang out with the younger dudes, and they were just killing it. So that's when I met Matthew Tucker, and I met Josh Daly, and I mm-hmm. met Jason Ellis, and actually my boy Alex Poole. And yeah, we started a band. They were actually already a band, and they kind of sounded like Rufio. They were
oh,
like
yeah.
still pop punk, but they kind of had this edginess to them. The very beginning, like seedlings of emo and screamo, and they didn't have a singer. They were just like, we don't have a singer. But I used to play at this coffee shop called the Placerville Coffee House. And, you know, that's kind of where we met. I would play there for open mic night, and I would play my guitar, and I'd play, you know, Count Crow's covers, and I'd play, you know, Duncan Sheik and Dave Matthews Band and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the drummer from 5 Minute Ride, they were already called 5 Minute Ride, and he approached me and was like, hey, man, we'd really like you to try out for the band. And so I tried out, and it was, you know, it was a good fit. So we started playing. And, I remember Matthew telling me, like, I want you to listen to this band from New Jersey. They're called One Breath. And it was the first time I had ever heard somebody emotionally scream. Like, you know, I mean, of course you hear Metallica and stuff like that. And, you know, there is screaming there in kind of a butt rock way, but,
yeah.
But I had never heard somebody like you could hear the emotion in his voice and the breaking of his vocal cords, and just the genuinity and just throwing it all out there, you know, hard on your sleeve sort of thing. And I was
right,
like, wow.
Right.
And he goes, I want you to sing like this. And I was like, okay, like I'll try to do that. And we were kind of, you know, kind of one of the first bands in my high school to do that. And we'd get a lot of crap for it, actually. It was like, oh, you know,
people make fun of it, sure.
screw those emo kids. Like, there's, oh, go cry somewhere. And we would just be like, haha, whatever, you know, like, we're having fun.
Well, I mean, 5 Minute Ride, and I want to get into all this Dance Gavin Dance stuff, in too, so I don't want to harp on this too much longer. But
yeah.
So 5 Minute Ride and Oh the Joy... you know, I said mentioned they're very solid bands, good records.
In fact,
to be honest with you, Kurt, like pretty much everything you've done, I don't want to say is flawless, but you have a very, very good track record with all your projects.
Thank you so much, man.
You guys got signed to Rise Records, and you put out a record. And I know Rise Records wasn't the Rise Records it is today.
Absolutely.
It was a lot smaller of a operation with, you know, Craig doing it all himself.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, if you were the old guy in the band, at the time, you guys must have been, were they still in high school when that record came out?
I want to say they had graduated. Like, I was waiting for them to graduate, and we would play, you know, around town. We would rent out, you know, VFW halls and stuff like that, and you know, the shows were nuts. You know, we'd play on the ground. It was just that awesome, just grassroots, you know, scene, and I loved it, and we were up in El Dorado Hills, Cameron Park area, which is even farther away from Citrus Heights. So then once we had kind of a fan base up there, a guy named Eric Rushing, he kind of approached all of us. And
Artery Foundation.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Runs the Ace of Spades, or at least used to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it got bought by House of Blues, but he still runs it. He's still, but
an instrumental man in the Sacramento scene, that's for sure.
Totally, totally. So yeah, I mean, I was managed by Eric for, gosh, I want to say like 8 or 9 years before before I was like, oh, okay, I think I got the hang of this. But yeah, so he kind of approached 5 Minute Ride and was like, hey, I want to sign you to my label 720 Records before the Artery Foundation. And things just kind of snowballed there. We played a New Year's Eve show with a band called Shorty and another band called Still Life Projector. And actually, I think it was because of Still Life Projector getting signed to Rise Records that we kind of got piggybacked onto that. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, do you guys want to sign to Rise? Still Life Projector just signed to Rise, and it seems like it's going really well, blah, blah, blah. They have Anatomy of a Ghost on there, and I was a pretty big fan of Anatomy of a Ghost back in the day. Yeah, and so I think they even had Fear Before the March of Flames as well. Yeah, they
did. You're right. That was kind of the big Rise band, actually.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, man, this is it. Like, it was really cool after that. Like, so that's kind of how we got signed to Rise, was through Eric Rushing. And Eric Rushing found us playing our shows in Cameron Park. And I believe we sent him like a press pack, like a video and a demo, and they loved it. And so, yeah, we became in cahoots because of that.
So did you know any of the Dance Gavin Dance guys at this point? When did you meet them, or was this completely separate?
Yeah. So right after Eric, kind of got us into the Sacramento scene, and we were playing the Boardwalk, and we would play this place called the Underground, which was a church, and then we even played like the Colonial Theater and whatnot. Will Swan was actually in a band, I think it's called Farewell Unknown. Okay. And 5 Minute Ride and Farewell Unknown used to play shows together. So that's kind of how we met. And, actually when I was still in 5 Minute Ride, we played a show with Dance Gavin Dance. I think it was a few shows actually. And 5 Minute Ride would play with The Fall of Troy. 5 Minute Ride would play with, Heavy Heavy Lolo, down in San Jose. Yeah. And even Taramellos. Taramellos was also in that group of bands. And also, we loved the metal and hardcore scene as well. So we would play with Embrace the End and a band called Beneath the Ashes. And the Sacramento scene has really just kind of kept a consistent amount of talented bands. And Embrace the End got signed to Century Media, and they did a bunch of stuff. And, obviously, Taramellos is on Sergeant House, which they're still doing really well, and The Fall of Troy and everything, and that's kind of how I met Thomas Arak, was because of that time as well. And so everything is kind of close knit. And
what a small world. Yeah,
exactly.
So you meet Will, your guys are playing in some bands together, obviously he goes on to form, I guess, Dance Gavin Dance, and then years go by. I'm not really sure. There's a bit of a period of time where I'm not sure what you're doing, but somehow you get the phone call that Johnny Craig's not in the band anymore, or they're kicking him out. And did you decide to try out? Did they call you? How did that happen?
So I remember I was on the light rail at the time, and my phone was about to get shut off, which is crazy. but I thought it was already shut off, and Eric had called me. And he was like, hey, do you know that band Dance Gavin Dance? I was like, yeah. And they're like, they want you to try out for the band. So I was like, oh crap. Like this is incredible. During that time I was doing Oh the Joy, And there was even another band that I was in called No Not Constant.
Right.
We put out a little EP. I love that EP.
It's like four songs, isn't it? It's like a real short EP. Yeah. It is good. Yep. But that goes back to what I'm saying about, you know, you've had a lot of great music come out. So there's all this stuff. Like, if people are a fan of you, there's so much stuff people can find out about, which is very cool. But anyways, go on.
So, I mean, I just kind of had always that mentality of like, well, something's going to pop. Like, I might as well just...
Right.
Might as well just keep making music until something happens. And then, the big break happened. I tried out for Dance Gavin Dance, and it was crazy. It was between me and Kellen Quinn from Sleeping with Sirens.
Yeah.
And it was kind of intimidating because I knew Kellen from another band, and we had actually played a couple shows together prior to this. And I remember they were like, they tried him out, they tried me out, and they said they really liked me, and we went to their practice spot, and they were like, yeah, well, we'll definitely let you know. And then they were like, well, hey, can you write a song? And I was just like, yeah, I can write a song, but like, I'm not in the band. Like, you know what I mean? So I remember not like throwing a fit, but well, if you want me to write, you gotta like choose me in the band.
Right.
And Kellen wrote one already. I think that's why they asked me. And I had heard it, and I was just like, man, if you want me in the band, like, you know, I'll write the song for sure. But I'm not gonna do it if you're not gonna, you know, if you're not gonna have me in the band. And if you want this guy, then cool. Like, that's it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I guess I kind of threw some, you know, some toot at them a little bit, and then they, I guess it was the right thing because they went with me. So, and it was actually that song, Uneasy Hearts Weigh the Most.
Well, what a weird world it would be in post-hardcore if it was Kellen Quinn, right? And
right.
That never happened, and then who knows what you would have done, and the space-time continuum, you know?
The parallel universe in which Kellen is in, Kellen is in DGD. Yeah.
Right, right. Absolutely. And if he still would be, or what would have happened. You know, going into that band, and I mean, Johnny Craig... At the time, I think it was a lot more under the radar, his extreme personality. But what was known about him was his voice. And
yes,
you still had some very big shoes to fill. And
oh my God.
That must have been, I mean, I don't know if you were prepared for that because they are big shoes.
Yes, yes. And you're absolutely right. I was not prepared. I had no idea the kind of backlash or ridicule that I would have seen online. It was incredible, because it's funny to think now, because you know, the people that like my voice, they definitely, nobody talks crap on me anymore. You know what I mean? Like, but when I was in the band, that was like the cool thing to do was, oh, bring Johnny back. We hate this new guy.
Yeah.
So it was... It was really interesting, and I had to literally not look at the comments. There were so many comments. I just had to be like, all right, I'm not going to look at them. I'm just going to do what I do, and, you know, it is what it is. And Johnny and I, actually, we've been friends before Dance Gavin Dance. We're friends now, and it's been a crazy journey, me and him, because I'm in the band, he's in the band, I'm in the band, you know what I mean?
Well, it's crazy. It's crazy,
yeah.
And I do want to talk about, you know, you're leaving, but, you know, now the aftermath, and it's 2019, you know, so we're talking about something that happened almost 10 years ago, or I guess it was 10 years ago.
It's crazy.
You know, but it's amazing that everybody's sort of come out of this respecting each other, even being friends, and even working together. You know, you still work with Will, you know, with your other bands on his label. And yes. you and Johnny have done solo tours, and you and Tillian have done solo tours, and you've come back to do all this stuff. And like, I don't think it's all just, you know, everyone's just like, oh, it's a paycheck. Like, there's friendship and there's respect there, which is incredible. Absolutely. Because so many times that does not happen.
Well, and you know, I don't know how to really say this, but you fight that sort of stigma forever. And you're like, I don't want to be associated with Johnny. I don't want to be associated with DGD. I want to be my own thing. But at the end of the day, you just kind of, you're like, well, this is my life. And mm-hmm. I'm thankful for what I have through this crazy roller coaster of a career.
Yeah.
And I think all of us, I can speak for all of us, even when, you know, Tillian and Tides of Man, and me being in DGD and Johnny doing the many projects that he's done. At this point, we embrace it and we are thankful right. for what we have, because there's not a lot of, honestly, there's not a lot of areas where you get those sort of opportunities. Like you, nobody would get any of these opportunities. And I work with other bands. I manage bands. I just picked up a band called Body Thief. They're incredible. They're from Maryland. And it's just, I see these incredible bands and they don't have a platform. They can't get a tour. They can't, you know, break through. And that was never an issue for us. You right. know what I mean? We always had this sort of fan base in this kind of subgenre, which is funny because I remember when I was in DGD, we had hard times trying to find good tours as well. And so we'd be like, you know what, screw this. Like, we're just going to go out and headline, and we're just going to go.
We're going to have to tour with Silverstein.
Yeah, that was a good one.
God help us.
No, that was a great one. But, you know, bands don't even get those kind of opportunities. And so
right.
when I look back, you know, I just think, gosh, how thankful I am to have a home, to have sort of a, right. this family that, you know, of musicians. And now DGD is bigger than ever before.
That's very
and
true.
So,
massive now. You know, crazy. It's crazy. It's like
only,
they've doubled. It's like they've doubled. Their shows have doubled in the last, you know, 2 or 3 years.
Oh my God. It's their time. Their time. And I'm so proud of all those guys. They never gave up. They stuck it out. And now they're reaping the benefits of all those hard times and those crazy decisions. And, you know, Will and I have had, you know, been crying in each other's arms saying, well, I'm so sorry about this and about that. And it's okay. You know, and
well,
it hasn't been easy, but you know, go ahead.
No, I mean, you know, I think the difference is you haven't been sitting around waiting, like by the phone, waiting for Dance Gavin Dance to call, you know,
you had a
full career with a lot like Birds. You've done all your solo stuff, all these other projects, all these other collaborations, you know, but you say they never gave up, you know, DGD never gave up, but they did give up on you.
Yeah,
I mean,
they
I'm
did.
Glad you laughed,
they
but
did.
It's true. I mean, going back to you did 2 records, both pretty good records. You know, John Mess, you know, left the band, came back, and then it seems like, I mean, you got ousted, you know, to bring Johnny Craig back. I mean, you weren't reading the comments, but clearly they were, and they thought that was the move they had to make. So what shook out there? Because it's pretty limited, you know, the information about what really happened.
They try and keep it pretty hush hush, and I've always told people individually, you know, even if somebody will comment and be like, "Why did you leave DGD?" It happened last night. It's never going away. Somebody asked, "Why did you leave DGD?" And I said, "You know what? I didn't leave. I got kicked out. Then, you know, I got kicked out for Johnny. Johnny got kicked out, and then they found themselves with Tillian, and now they're with Tillian." And
well, that's the 10-second story,
right? So, I mean, if we really, really want to get into it, when I joined DGD, I smoked a pack a day, literally smoked a pack a day, smoked as much weed as I could, literally. And I am no saint. There are a lot of other drugs that I've done in my life. And DGD is no secret. Like, they are party dudes.
Yes.
Obviously they've probably slowed down a little bit, but I honestly don't think so. You know, they're
well, the tour,
that's just who they are.
The tour did in 2010 was pretty intense. Like, there, you know, there were nights, there was one night I remember, like, I think we were in Seattle or something, and I like went to say bye to you guys, and it was like, well, everyone's too fucked up to drive the van, so I don't know. We're just going to have to get, like, the least fucked up person to make it to the next show. I'm like, don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't drive. Yeah. Like, you guys are fucking crazy.
They are. They're absolutely crazy, and I was right there with them. So, yeah. And the fact that Johnny, you know, can drink like a freaking fish and everything under the sun and just get up on stage and not hit a sour note the entire show is incredible.
Yeah.
It's a freaking miracle. And yeah, I was trying to keep up with those guys and I can't. I need my tea. I need, you know, I can't drink before the show. I need my in-ear monitors, like that sort of thing. Like, I've learned that now. But when I was, you know, young, and when I was in my early 20s in DGD, I did not do that. I did whatever I wanted before the show. I did whatever I wanted after the show. And it definitely affected my live performance. And I remember there was a European tour that was really rough. I remember, like, me and Matt Mingus went in on a carton of cigs from America, and we thought they were going to last for the whole tour, and they didn't. And so then we started smoking the European ones, and those are way more harsh, and they just ruined my voice, just totally screwed it up. And I remember it's probably my worst performances, man. And yeah. To go back to your question, I think that's what it was. It was like, man, Kurt is sucking ass right now.
Right.
And everybody wants Johnny in the band. And of course, Johnny can do whatever he wants, and he sings like a freaking angel. So it's like, I don't blame them. At the time, it was probably a no-brainer. It was like, Johnny wants back in. Kurt doesn't really sound very good live right now. And I think that was all it was, you know. And I remember Will calling me and saying, hey, Kurt, I'm not happy with Dance Gavin Dance right now the way it is. And so I think I'm going to end the band. And I'm sure he's had these ideas of ending Dance Gavin Dance many, many times.
How could you not?
Yeah. So he told me, he was like, hey, but I just want to let you know, we're going to get Johnny back in the band for one last tour. And that's that. That's what we're going to do. And so I think the one last tour, they just kept going and, well, let's do another album and yeah, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. So you don't feel like there was there was as much bad intentions towards ousting you as, like, you know, as it maybe appears now.
Yeah, I don't think it was a personality thing. I don't think it was even, you know, they didn't like my voice. I just think it was, all right, this ship is sinking, and mm-hmm, we need to do something quick, and we need to do something drastic, and this is the right publicity stunt to to get everybody back on board. And I can't imagine, you know, because they had to kick him out again. I can't imagine what they must have felt when they kicked out Johnny again and was just like, well, crap, what do we do? Kurt's already in a lot like Birds, and he probably hates us right now. You know what I mean?
Well, was there a bit of relief too? I mean, it seems like you were in the band for, what, 2.5 years or so, and it was like kind of hellish for you, right, with everything you had to do. And then A Lot Like Birds seemed like, I mean, it's a great band too, obviously not as popular, but maybe better in terms of your, you know, your psyche and your, you know, just well-being. Is that
fair? It was crazy, man. When I found a lot like Birds, absolutely. I was like, yes, this feels right. These guys are incredible. Joseph Arrington, just the best drummer I've ever seen, you know, and I was just like, holy crap, I found a gold mine with these guys.
Yeah.
And the Law Dispute Band, Touche Amore, Loma Prieta, all those bands were like really killing it. And I loved A Lot Like Birds and their spoken word aspect to their music, and just it kind of felt like this new sound of emo was coming out, and I wanted to be on the forefront of that. I was like, yes, this is what I want. And it's crazy the amount of offers I was getting to join other bands. You know, there Tides of Man. I got an offer to join Tides of Man after I got kicked out.
How weird would that, Amoroso, would that have been?
I
switched places,
dude,
with
honestly,
the dude.
Tillian, yeah, Tillian called me up and was like, "Dude, I want you to try out for Tides of Man. I'm going to be singing with Seosin."
Oh yeah, and so, that whole thing, of course.
Yeah, and I was like, "Dude, there's no way I can sing your freaking songs." And he was like, "Dude, you totally can. Your range is just as high as mine." And blah blah blah. And I was like, "Yeah, right, bro." Like, but so I turned that down. Amorosa actually approached me and was like, "Hey, do you want to sing for Amorosa?" And I was like, "I'm not doing that again. I'm not filling. You know what I mean? I'm not yeah, gonna be man. The Johnny Craig part two. You know, again." and then another one that I almost took was Of Mice and Men. My boy, Tino yeah. was, but he hit me up and I actually did say yes. I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this. They got me a plane ticket. Shaley was out of the band, I guess, and they needed a singer guitar player. And I was like, dude, this might work. This sounds cool. And I just, the night before I tossed in turns and was just like, this isn't me. I had to call him up and be like, dude, I love you so much, but I just can't see myself in this band.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times I think about what could have happened with Of Mice and Men and me, you know, if I would be in the band now or what, because they're obviously larger than life as well. And
yeah, absolutely.
It would have been a good move, and I could have had the same platform to write my own stuff or, you know, do whatever I wanted to. But A Lot Like Birds felt right. It was like, this is the sound I want. These guys are incredible musicians and I want to do this. And so I made my decision and I'm actually really, really thankful I did.
Yeah, man, absolutely. It seems like when you left A Lot Like Birds, you know, you guys made some very good albums together. I have a fan question later about A Lot Like Birds I want to ask you too. But yeah. It seemed like it kind of just boom. It was over. Like, was there unfinished business there? How did that all come about? Because it didn't seem like over the course of time it faded away. It seemed like kind of it was a all of a sudden it was gone.
Well, I'm sure you know in the music industry, it's a lot about saving face. Mm-hmm. It's a lot about not airing out your dirty laundry, you know. And,
uh-huh. yeah.
and there were a lot of internal struggles between me and other people in the band. And we were really, really working hard to kind of keep the ship sailing and keep it afloat. But at the end of the day, it was just kind of musical differences. And I just kind of felt like the magic had left. And so because of all the projects that I've been a part of and left, it was really, really easy for me to say, you know what? My heart's not in it anymore. I'm done.
Right.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. You know, I tried to compromise with those guys and, basically, they were drastically changing their sound, and I was not for it. I was like, dudes, we've we've worked so hard to get where we're at, and why would we completely change our sound to go for another fan base? And, you know, I just thought it was not a good decision.
Right.
And lots of very, I don't want to say stubborn, but just very, well, I guess I said stubborn. So
that's fine. I mean, that's a word that, you know, maybe an underused word for a lot of people, you know, because right. people are.
They just very set in their ways. Basically, I was like, okay, I hear this sound. Yes, I know what you're going for. But we also can't abandon the sound that we have been working for, you know, working, trying to build for 5-6 years now. So I wanted to be like, yo, you got to write 5 a lot like Bird songs. And then we'll take the best 5 of this new sound and incorporate that into our next record. And yeah, they put it to a vote and they didn't want to do it. So I was like, all right, well, I can't do this. I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
If it's not going to sound like a lot like Birds, I might as well just do my solo project,
right?
You know, or I'll just find something else, you know. And it was one of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make. Really, I loved that band. I still do. The lyrics in those albums that we wrote, and just the compositions of those songs, I'm very, very, very proud of.
Absolutely.
And when Divizi came out without me, I definitely listened to it and I was like, wow, this sounds a lot better than the demos that they showed me. Dang it. You know what I mean? Like, so.
Well, it takes a big man. It takes a big man to admit that too. So,
yeah. So Divizi was an incredible record, and part of me wishes that I would have just stuck it out and stayed in the band.
Right.
But I think it was for the best, honestly. Well, I really do. I got to focus on my solo project a lot more, and you know, I really had a chance to start building that moniker up.
Absolutely.
By touring extensively with that.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about all that before I let you go, but I do have a fan question related to what we just talked
yeah.
about from Dustin Harrell. And
okay.
Here's what he says. He says, the A Lot Like Birds album, No Place, connected with me on so many levels that I got the entire album art tattooed on my thigh with the words,
"Wow,
I think I'm okay now." I was curious on the song No Nurture. Was that song written to fit the album, or was it more from personal experience?
Wow. That's an incredible question. And yes, it definitely, all those songs were written to fit sort of a theme. Every song was a different room in the house.
Right.
And that song, No Nurture, was the living room. And the living room to me really kind of signified kind of the family song, you know. And Corey's lyrics are very explicit when he says, you know, things about his father. And I was definitely working off of that. But I was also, I quit smoking cigs.
Oh,
on
good
that,
for you. Congratulations.
That record. Yeah, it's been so long now. It's so me and Corey were writing about the living room, and for me it was about that, but it was also about me quitting cigarettes. And I had not had a smoke 2 weeks, and then we went and recorded that album, and it was much easier by myself. But at that time, almost everybody in A Lot Like Birds smoked cigs. So it was really, really hard for me to be around them.
Yeah.
There was a point when we were recording that I remember buying a pack of cigarettes and just staring at them. And I walked over to the overpass and I just started bawling and I threw them over the overpass. And to me, I think that lyric that was just a very therapeutic, symbolic moment for me of, I think I'm all right. I think I'm okay. I'm not getting any younger, and much more aware of that. And I think I'm okay now. And it definitely had to do with family, but it also had an underlying sense of me letting go of something.
Wow.
Me letting go of something that I definitely held dear. I loved smoking cigarettes. It was like it was my thing. I was very heavily addicted, pack a day guy.
Yeah.
So I haven't had a cigarette since we recorded that record, 2 weeks prior to that record. And I stuck to it, and it was, one of those things that is always going to be a pinnacle moment in my life. It was when I like overcame that addiction.
Good for you. It's interesting the parallels you have with smoking to Cove from Saleson. You know,
really,
almost the same thing happened to him. He had so much stress with Anthony Green filling Anthony Green's shoes and people saying, "Oh, where the hell is Anthony?" that he started smoking because of the stress.
Yeah.
And then that led to his voice having major vocal issues too, and him getting ousted from Saleson.
Yeah. It's so crazy. Cove on a way bigger hill, in my opinion, you know, like, holy crap, what shoes to fill. You know, that Anthony Green's literally the dude. He did an incredible job, and I can't imagine how that must have, you know, took a toll on him.
Yeah. Well, it did. I did two episodes with Cove just, you know, a couple months ago. And, you know, now he's...
Oh, cool.
He took a long hiatus from music where he went back to working, you know, regular jobs and stuff. He wasn't doing music at all. And now he's in a new band called Dead American. They're doing the Beartooth tour. So it's really good, really good to see him back on his feet as well.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, man. So you got a lot of stuff going on still right now. I really want to make sure everybody knows what you got going on. You got your band Royal Coda, which is signed to Will's Blue Swan Records. You guys are playing Swan Fest.
Yep.
You have another band called Pushover with Thomas Eric as well, or Iraq. I never knew how to say his last name.
Yeah.
And Iraq, Strawberry Girl is another band you're kind of in. Not to mention Eternity Forever, which was, I think, still happening. And you have Esk Records.
Yeah.
Does that about cover it? Oh, and you manage Adventurer, and you also manage that other band from Maryland that you mentioned.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of things I got my hands in, for sure. So.
How do you do it, man? How do you schedule that? You wake up in the morning and you say, I got 10 million things to do, and not to mention who's going to call me, like what's it going to be today? Just seems overwhelming.
Well, I try to do my best, man. Some days are better than others, and there's a lot of fans commenting, where's this project, or where's this project, or are you going to do this, or are you going to do that? And the answer is yes, but all in due time, and I never try and rush anything. That's also another thing is I don't really care when I put this stuff out. When it's right is when I'll put it out, and when we'll put it out. But I can say that I just got back from Detroit, recording new Pushover track. There will be an EP out on Esk Records very soon, and probably our first tour, me and Thomas, as Pushover. Royal Coda's gearing up to doing another album. I think I'm in the studio this April with Royal Coda. And I'm currently doing a solo album, which I haven't done in 4 years, which a lot of people have been saying, hey, when are you going to do some new stuff? And it's like, well, I put out a split and I did the Eternity Forever EP, you know, and so I've been really kind of pushing those efforts. But now now I'm definitely focusing on my solo work and Royal Coda and Pushover. And Thomas has his own side project called Thomas Arak yeah. and the Shoreline.
Yeah.
And it's actually also out on Blue Swan Records. And so me and him, you know, we're not in a hurry. We're not in a rush to put anything out. We've got plenty of projects to keep going with. But when we're happy with it, we'll put it out. And, same goes with literally everything I do is when I think it's ready, we'll definitely put it out.
Well, I think that's a great mantra. I think that's a great mantra to have, Kurt. And I think that that does speak to your body of work because with all the different things you've done, sang on, people you've collaborated, it really is a tremendous, you know, I give you an A to an A plus on it.
Oh, thank you so much, man. It's really
inspiring, you know, that you can be pushed and pulled in so many directions and have so much stuff. And still it's like every song is like pretty good, imaginative, creative, and is actually saying something. So I think that's a good thing to draw. It's just, hey, don't rush things. Make sure that at the end of the day, no matter what drama goes on behind the scenes, the song is good. And I think that's right. That speaks to you.
Thank you so much, Shane. And I really, really appreciate you. It's really a treat. It's very cool for me to be on here. So thank you so much.
Oh, of course, dude. You wouldn't believe the amount of requests I've had for you. So I'm glad I'm glad we could connect, and I feel like it's a great time to talk, you know, with everything coming up. Everybody should check out Esk Records, which you run with your wife, Lauren, and all these projects you're doing, and your solo stuff. But, you know, I always play music on this podcast at the end of the show.
Yeah.
Now I have a lot of trouble picking a song, for you. So maybe I'll ask you if you don't mind picking a tune, something, you know, it can be really from any of your projects, but just something that maybe, you know, you'd like people to hear that you're proud of.
Totally. I think right off the bat, I would say listen to Anything to Save by Royal Coda. It's a great song. It's very high energy and just really kind of showcases what I can do.
Okay.
So.
All right.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that answer, man. Anything to Save. Here it is.
Yeah.
On Lead Singer Syndrome.
There is Kurt Travis's Royal Coda with the song Anything to Save. And wasn't that cool? Man, so much there. And thank you so much, Kurt, for taking the time to do that, especially out of your busy studio day. And yeah, get ready for that solo record that's going to drop independently. Check out Esk Records. Check out just everything this guy's got going on. Follow him on Twitter or I don't know. Just go. Just consume. This guy has an incredible track record. And thank you for being here once again with me. Next week, we will be back. I will be in Asia, actually. Singapore, to be exact. One of the members of the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club, a top tier member. He's getting married. I'm playing his wedding. I'm doing an emo night Singapore. It's going to be a blast. But don't worry, I will have a new episode up for your consumption. And it's a good one. Another very informative one. Bit of a different vibe, but that's what we like to do on this show. Once again, thank you so much for tuning in. Enjoy the rest of your cold week. And I'll see you next time. Peace and love.